Welcome to the Young China Watchers podcast. My name is Sam Colomby. Young China Watchers is a global network of young professionals. We organize talks by China experts in our 10 chapters around the world. One of the events we organize is an annual conference in partnership with the Lao China Institute at King's College London. This year, the conference fell on the 2nd of November, and the theme of the day was PRC at 70, Beyond the Headlines. The podcast today will feature highlights from some of the speakers at the conference. We start with an introduction by James Tunningley, head of our London chapter.
So what's happened with China since our last conference about a year ago? Well, it kicked off with US Vice President Mike Pence's speech at the Hudson Institute, which set the scene for quite a rocky year in US-China trade tensions. Meng Wanzhou was arrested in Canada, and also people like Meng Hongwei, the former Chinese head of Interpol, was also arrested and expelled from the Communist Party. Italy also became the first G7 country to sign an MOU around the Belt and Road. There was lots of heat on China and the UN around human rights in Xinjiang, and the last several months have been dominated by the protests that have been continuing in Hong Kong. But the theme of today suggests from the headline that we're going to be looking beyond some of these sort of buzzword media headlines to dissect what's really, really going on, to sort of respond to and look beyond the sensationalization and oversimplification of a lot of China-related issues.
Next, we'll hear from Dr. Igor Rogolya, teaching fellow at the Lao China Institute.
So Carrie Brown, who regrettably could not make it and sends his apology, as well as sending me, he usually finds a sort of fitting metaphor for the relations of the world with China. I think his recent favorite is talking about how the world is essentially moving from a bungalow to a two-story house, and many accidents happen on the stairs. You know, there isn't a day that goes by without seeing some sort of fight on Twitter between, you know, old China hands and various young Turks and so on. And I think we've always had these almost comical divisions between, you know, panda huggers and dragon slayers. And I really think it's up to us to actually transcend these simplistic narratives and really provide in-depth analysis and considered thought, you know, condemn what needs to be condemned and to admire what needs to be admired without resorting to sort of all sorts of essentialist or alarmist language.
Our keynote speaker was Jonathan Fenby, who many of you will recognize as a prolific author on China and also chairman of the China team at TS Lombard.
A mixture of confidence and what I call concern needs to be viewed as a major aspect in looking at China behind the headlines. China is there to stay. It will remain at the forefront of international affairs, at least for my lifetime and probably for yours. But equally, its path is strewn with challenges. And what is interesting is that many of them are the product of that very growth and expansion of home and abroad, which has so changed the world. So we get the price of success, in a way, which now the leadership in Beijing is, I think, having to face. China's higher profile and greater influence around the world is inevitably rising concern about its aims and motives. China's foreign policy as a whole remains based on bilateralism. Belt and Road, for instance, is what is known as a hub and spoke arrangement, with all roads leading to Beijing. This, I think, limits the impact and the lasting nature of Chinese agreements and alliances around the world. But for all the satisfaction, which was evident around the time of the 70th anniversary celebrations, it is not surprising that Beijing worries about the risks and challenge facing it, particularly given that China has shown an application rarely seen in other countries to building up its strength and developing its growth by a leadership which brooks no opposition. The link between success and the fault lines which this breeds is central, I think, to any evaluation of the PRC and its future. It means that policy decisions made in Beijing, for one reason, may have a negative effect in another area. And this counterbalance always has to be watched. The daily headlines capturing the immediate news and focusing on specific events and data releases do not capture this much broader story of what one can only call internal contradictions. But it is there that the future of China and its impact on the world, which we and you are watching, will lie.
On to the first of our three panels, which was moderated by Young China Watcher Frederick Ladbury,
Hi, my name's Frederick Ladbury. I'm a director of operations at YCW, and I chaired the first panel of the day, which was on science and technology in China. We had three panelists. We had Dr. Mathieu Bernay, who is an associate professor of global law at Queen Mary University. We had Adam Knight, who is a PhD candidate at the University of Leiden and the co-founder of Tong Digital. And we had Stephen Jiawei Hai, who is a PhD student at the Lao China Institute here at King's College London, where we hosted the event. We spoke about a range of themes, including the interplay between data and law, the interplay between private businesses and public institutions, both in China and abroad, and of course, the interplay of actors within China with actors outside China, both within China's neighbors and more broadly in Europe and North America.
We'll be listening to Adam Knight, PhD candidate and co-founder of Tong, who spoke on our perception of China's technological advancement and the implications of a fully developed China model. I'll also include Adam's response to a question from the audience.
There's a strong degree of, I guess, techno-orientalism, essentially, that permeates a lot of conversation around science, technology, etc. in China. I think there are two angles to that. Partly, it's a misunderstanding, I think, of actually the capabilities that are currently in place. The way that policy is being designated at the top level does not necessarily filter down beyond that, whether it be in private companies or whether it be in municipal governments, departments, etc. The second angle to that is more of the kind of orientalist angle, which is that we tend to, I think, project a lot of our own fears about technology onto China, when these are issues that we're, of course, grappling with here as well. I most commonly come across this when similar discussions to this, and people ask, and maybe somebody was going to ask this, about Chinese attitudes to things like privacy and what have you. And this assumption, incorrect, I think, that Chinese citizens don't care about privacy and that they're happy to sacrifice privacy for the sake of convenience or what have you. And that's just a fundamentally flawed viewpoint. It's obviously grossly generic, for starters. It's a rather large population. But it also, I think, overlooks the fact that in our own markets here in Europe and America, we also, until very recently, arguably until, say, Cambridge Analytica scandal, also had absolutely no idea what big tech companies or governments were doing with our data, and arguably also didn't really care. What we're seeing is a kind of what's called the balkanization of the internet, right? So this splitting down of the World Wide Web into smaller and smaller entities that often follow kind of geographic lines. And this is something, again, not exclusive to China. We're seeing it in many, many other countries. And partly it's an explicit policy of some national governments to do that, as it is in China, either for economic protectionism or to control the population. But partly it's also just how people use the internet. If I'm a Chinese person and I search for something online, I'm going to want to search for something in Chinese and find Chinese links. So there's that side of things. But having said that, the second element, I think, is that there is a distinct policy at the top level in China to create a kind of so-called Chinese model of internet governance. The kind of slightly concerning thing we're seeing at the moment is the export of that model to other countries. Often, the payback is not just in cash, whether it's, you know, in debt diplomacy and what have you, but also data-driven. You look at places like Zimbabwe, for example, recently introduced a facial recognition system rolled out nationwide. But part of that deal was that all of that data, facial recognition data, was to be sent back to China as well to help train those facial recognition algorithms on a wider variety of ethnicities and faces that is just not accessible within the Chinese market.
You talked about China trying to kind of export this model of digital authoritarianism. So I've got kind of three basic questions. First of all, should that be countered? Should that be resisted? Second of all, how can that be done? You know, how can alternative to that be best presented? And the third question is who should be involved in kind of leading that effort?
Good. Should it be countered? Yes. Who should do it and how? We shouldn't silo technology and see it as being some kind of separate entity that isn't connected to everything else. I think so much of having a free and open internet is actually much more to do with much older, more ingrained institutions like rule of law, freedom of speech, these kind of things that are not as easily exported.
Are there any steps at all that China can possibly do to reduce the growing US narrative of an unstoppable, high-tech, watertight totalitarianism in early stages growing in China?
I think I have a slightly this perhaps a kind of tongue-in-cheek viewpoint on this, which is that I think China quite likes its bad boy rep on the international stage when it comes to the kind of use of technology in particular. There are two reasons for that. One is that when it comes to exporting these technologies, again, whether it be the hardware or whether it be the kind of ideology that underpins all of that, it helps. It's kind of a bit of a sales pitch. For countries that are looking for a third way, for countries that are looking for an alternative to a US model, either because it doesn't suit them or because they've got sanctions against them, China is, you know, the go-to place. The second aspect to it is that actually you see in things like social credit is a good example, or AI, or indeed, you know, various other kind of aspects where you have this intersection of technology and society, that the kind of media hype or narrative that we see outside of China actually does a great service to Chinese officials, where they can say quite obviously all of this is not true. All of this is fake news, it's false reporting, it's not good quality journalism. As a result, that gives us reason to also argue that all of this other reporting, say on Xinjiang, say on Hong Kong, is also undermined and biased and just not factually correct. So I think those are the kind of two reasons that I think actually the narrative that the US puts forward helps China more than it hinders it.
Our second panel was moderated by James Tunningley, who you've heard at the beginning.
Hello, my name is James Tunningley. I'm the head of YCW here in London. I chaired the panel on Chinese diplomacy and the developing world, which featured Linda Calabrese, who is a research fellow at the ODI, Bill Hayton, who is an associate fellow at Chatham House, and Kofi Gannou, who is a Rhodes Scholar at the University of Oxford. We had a thrillingly exciting panel, which explored some of the nuances of China's relationship beyond the United States, the European Union, and India, to Chinese diplomacy with the global South or the developing world. Two thoughts. One, China is filling a vacuum in terms of infrastructure investment requirements across the world, but predominantly in Africa and Southeast Asia. And secondly, of the importance of plurilateral free trade areas. What will the future of, for example, the Africa Continental Free Trade Area and the Free Trade Area of the Asia Pacific mean for Chinese diplomacy, both economically and in order to win hearts and minds?
Our featured speaker for panel two is Linda Calabrese, a development economist with 4 years' experience working in East Africa. I'll once again include a question from the audience.
I think it's really important that we move beyond the tired debt trap diplomacy narrative that's been around for a while. So I think it's important to talk about other things as well. And I think to understand China's presence in the developing world, we have to go beyond this box of China. And we need to define a bit better what are we talking about exactly. There's so many actors that are involved, and it's important to understand their motivations and their drivers in this engagement. So we can think about the Chinese policy banks that lend for infrastructure projects in energy, in transport, and so on. But these banks need to do sustainable lending, meaning they need to be able to get the money back in order to lend more. Then we have the large state-owned enterprises, very often engaged in constructing large infrastructure projects. Now, these are state-owned, so of course, again, they have a policy motivation, but they're also enterprises, so they need to operate at a profit. And then we have a large number of private-owned enterprises. They've set up firms and companies in many sectors, manufacturing, agriculture, extractives, and so on and so forth. So these may be smaller in volume, because these investments are smaller, but there's many of them. They are large in numbers. And the drivers that lead them to invest abroad really depend both on the country and on the sector that they invest in. There's push factors, and these have to do with the increasing costs in China, increased competition among firms that tend to crush the smaller firms that are less well-established. And then there's pull factors. These depend on the country that these companies invest in. So, for example, if we talk about Ethiopia, what drives Chinese companies to invest in Ethiopia? Well, one, it's the market size. It's a very big market, 100 million people. Two is the market access that Ethiopia has to other countries. If you produce in Ethiopia and export to the US or the UK, you can export duty-free. And three, these countries have much lower income per capita, and therefore they can offer lower wages to the workers. So if we want to understand China's engagement in developing countries, we need to understand that this is the result of all these forces. And then, of course, we need to understand that each country, again, is different, and in each country there are forces at play that shape the engagement with China. There's, say, the government that wants to get something done before the next election, and then there's the opposition that will want to defeat the government, and then there's the business community in the country, some of which will be able to work with China or be employed or provide services, and some of which will not. And therefore, again, the results of all these forces is what shapes the relationship finally. It's important to understand what are the nuances at play here, that we don't just talk about China's engagement in these countries. But however, if you are a non-resource-rich country, Chinese companies are one of the few options you have. China is the fifth largest in terms of investment stocks in Africa at the moment. And if you look at where do the others invest, really it's mostly focused on extractive industries and financial services. Whereas China, the investment for 2015 is a lot more diversified. 28% goes to extractive, 27% goes to construction, 13% goes to manufacturing. Therefore, if you are a country that wants to promote its manufacturing sector, China is one of the few options you have in terms of investors.
Obviously, there's a huge need for infrastructure in the global south. Now, if the OECD and Western donors don't cater towards that need, and also obviously private companies, as we've heard, how can the West, how can the European Union, how can we be complementary?
Of course, OECD countries, or the West, broadly termed, cannot offer the same finance for investment and so on. I don't think there's capacity. I don't think there's appetite. I think there's also a lot of questioning from taxpayers in these countries on how aid is spent. There's a lot of other things that can be done. On the infrastructure side, if you think the countries that are negotiating with China do not have capacity to financial capacity or human resources capacity or technical capacity to assess these deals, maybe try and support building that capacity. If you think that investing in manufacturing is good, for example, you don't have control over the actual producers that go and invest in these countries, but you can work with the global brands, the H&M, the Gap and Zara and whatnot, and help them, invite them, think about these countries as destinations in a way that's more sustainable in terms of production, looking at labor standards, environmental standards, and so on. So I don't think I'm saying much new, actually. I think these are all initiatives that are in some way in place at very small scale at the moment. So this could be ramped up.
The last panel was moderated by Young China Watcher, Sarah Montgomery.
My name's Sarah Montgomery. I'm a director at Young China Watchers, and today I've been hosting and moderating the panel discussing the rise of China's millennials. On our panel today, we had three expert speakers. We had Yuan Ren, who is a Chinese culture and tech journalist, Arnold Ma, the founder of Qmin, and also Vincent Ni, senior journalist at the BBC and Yale Greenberg World Fellow. I think some great insights that came from the panel today included Vincent's perspective that he shared on the importance of looking at the rise of China's millennials from a more granular perspective, rather than just making sweeping judgments, looking at the differences in, for example, geographical locations, their dialects, and what influence that will then have on the different values and different identity of China's millennials. I think that nicely also ties in with what both Yuan and Arnold were saying about the importance of looking at the socioeconomic class within China's millennials to notice the difference there. Arnold's comments on how much social media has influenced China's millennials, fueled by social media acting much more as a creator platform, allowing much more individual perspectives to be shared and also to be shared at scale.
For this panel, we'll be listening to journalist Vincent Ni.
I think when we talk about young people in China, there's a general misunderstanding outside of China. If you Google young Chinese people, one of the first results pop up will be one of the articles written by Foreign Policy, China's youth trapped in the cult of nationalism. Certainly at a
time when China is somewhat, you know, seemingly to be confronting with, in particular, the United States, it's very easy to see young people being patriotic and being understood as, you know, being super nationalistic. I think, you know, to some extent, this will be misunderstanding. I think growing up in China at a time of enormous change, that's also a process of looking for your own identity of being Chinese. So what does that mean to be Chinese? I personally do think this question has not been properly understood. The second thing, I think, because China is a vast country, you know, if you travel from Shanghai to Beijing, they are completely two different parts of the world. This means that there's a huge variety of young Chinese people, even within China. So, you know, if you were to try to understand what Chinese, today's Chinese millennials in general are about, there's a lot of room to improve in terms of our understanding of this generation. And I think, you know, for me as a journalist myself, this is our responsibility to tell the stories of a vast country like China. And I think, you know, that the nuance is usually missing when, you know, you are writing, you know, big topics like nationalism, geopolitics, etc. But the truth of the matter, there are just, you know, different people with different views, different, you know, views of the world, different expectations of themselves, different opinions about their governments. Sometimes they express them explicitly, sometimes they don't. And I think, you know, these are the things that we often kind of overlook when we are looking at, when we are talking about this generation in China. I think there's a lot of nuance in that.
Do students who study overseas return to China with a greater sense of what it means to be Chinese? And if so, what is the answer?
You know, China's opening up to the world, sending students overseas and letting them enjoy the high quality of education for a long time has had a positive effect. And I think the danger now is that we seem to be trapped in this detrimental thinking that, you know, you either think, you know, Chinese students going to the West couldn't be changed at all, or you think, you know, you still have the hope that they will be changed overnight. I think, you know, I reject either of these presumptions. I think it is a gradual process. I think, you know, sending students to the West to study has had a positive effect on the country. And, you know, China is a very kind of hierarchical society where if you are not, you know, at a certain age, you wouldn't be able to have this sort of discourse power, right? This is changing, and that's why it's so surprising, you know, you suddenly hear, you know, Me Too movement is also taking place in China. And not long ago in Peking University, there were, you know, Marxist activists being detained by the government, etc. I think the government should also renew its contract with part of its population, not just the urban business elites, but also properly looking to what the younger generation are thinking, because these are the people who will shape the country, its dreams and nightmares in the next decades to come.
That wraps up the highlights from the 2019 Young China Watchers Lao China Institute Conference, held in London on the 2nd of November. If you enjoyed listening to these speakers, you can find a report and a full recording on our website, youngchinawatchers.com. We hope to see you at next year's conference. My name is Sam Colomby. The music in this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions.